Case number 02-1135 et al. Sierra Club Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency et al. Mr. Pugh for the petitioner Sierra Club et al. Ms. Powell for petitioners Sierra Club et al. And Mr. Durkee for the respondents.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Pugh, and along with my colleague Carrie Powell, I will be presenting argument for petitioners today. I will present argument on EPA's exemption of virtually all major sources of hazardous air pollutants from any obligation to comply with Clean Air Act emission standards when they start up, shut down, or malfunction, and Ms. Powell will address EPA's deletion of existing regulatory requirements requiring sources to prepare and implement adequate plans to minimize emissions when startups and shutdowns and malfunctions occur. On the startup shutdown malfunction, Section 112 of the Act requires EPA to set emission standards for all major sources of hazardous air pollutants. Those Section 112 standards must satisfy the stringency requirements in Sections 112D2 and 3, and they also have to conform to the definition of emission standard in Section 302K by limiting emissions on a continuous basis. Because of the exemption we're challenging here, EPA's Section 112 standards do not limit emissions on a continuous basis. The regulation states directly that emission standards do not apply during startup, shutdown, or malfunction. And as the record shows, startup, shutdowns, and malfunctions occur routinely.
Well, let me be clear, so I understand. I thought EPA's response to all that was the general duty is the default during these periods, and that based on their experience over time, the agency has looked at these SSM events, and on occasion, and I need to be clear about that with the agency, on occasion, maybe it's more than on occasion, has adjusted the MAC standards to address these repetitive instances, at least of startup and shutdown.
Well,
so the response is that there are standards that apply during this period.
I guess just to start with the first part of that question, EPA does say that the duty that applies during startup, shutdown, and malfunction is the different duty, this general duty to operate equipment consistent with good safety, good air pollution practices and safety for minimizing emissions. That's the only duty that applies.
Oh, to the maximum make to reduce. I can't remember the.
It's for minimizing emissions.
Minimize to the greatest extent possible, consistent with.
Well, no, Your Honor. There are a number of things in that sentence. First, it says to operate equipment consistent with safety and good air pollution practices.
But it's to minimize emissions to the greatest extent which is consistent with safety and good air pollution control practices.
I believe the most recent version just says for minimizing emissions, but it is essentially the same general duty. That's what applies during startup, shutdown, and malfunction. But it's also true that there in a handful of the MACT regulations for different categories, EPA has required more than that. But for the vast majority, that's all that applies. There's the exemption and this general duty requirement.
This 112 is just stationary sources.
These are just stationary sources. In fact,
do you have an automobile?
I do.
You do? Yeah. Do you start it up?
I do.
Do you realize that your catalytic converter doesn't start working in startup?
Yes, I understand that.
Yeah. You're not violating the law by starting that car, are you?
No, there's no law that requires me to comply with. Well, anyway, thank you, Your Honor. The problem with EPA's argument about the general duty requirement is that the Clean Air Act requires Section 112 emission standards to apply at all times, not just that there be some requirement
But it doesn't have to be the same requirement, right? Continuous means there has to be a standard.
Well,
does it have to be the same standard all the time?
Yes, Your Honor. If section.
Well, suppose. I don't know. I'm not sure I understand why these SSM events are different. But could they have a standard that, for example, was based on the maximum achievable reduction measured by the best performing sources during startup, shutdown, and maintenance?
Well, when I look at some of these standards, I think that may be precisely what they're doing. But I don't think that would be proper. But
it wouldn't?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think that, you know, the maximum degree of reduction probably wouldn't. The standard, a proper standard set under Section 112D2 would be a number. It wouldn't simply be a narrative that says.
Oh no! I understand. No, what they do is study, and they look at, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these of how stationary sources do during startup, shutdown, and maintenance, and then they set the standard at the maximum, whatever the best performing source is doing during those phases. That's all. It would be a standard, but it would be different from the non-SSM time. But it would be based on the best performing source.
Your Honor, I don't think that would be proper, but fortunately the court doesn't have to reach it here, because that's not what they're doing. There's no dispute that this general duty is not a Section 112 emission standard.
Okay, so your
time.
Point is then, your the petitioner's point is that 112D provides a standard that must apply continuously.
That's right. I mean, the text.
And there's only two exceptions to that. That's your argument, right?
The two exceptions.
To the practicality, basically.
Oh, I mean, there is a provision in Section 112 for EPA to set work practice standards. Rather
yeah,
than
I understand. But so they couldn't. There's no way to fashion a 112D compliant standard for startup, shutdown, and maintenance that would be different from the standard applicable during non-SSM times. Is that right?
I think my answer to that is yes. But just to be clear, if you're
asking.
Wait
a minute, then maybe I should ask the question, because I'm not sure what yes meant. I'm sorry, I asked the question the wrong way. Your position is that there must be a continuous and unchanging Section 112D compliance standard applicable all the time.
Yes.
They can't come up with a different 112D standard based on the best performing sources during startup, shutdown, and maintenance.
Now I understand the question. I think the answer is yes. I don't think they could do that, but they certainly haven't ever tried.
I know. I'm trying to find out whether there's any exactly what your theory is. I know they've never tried it. But they seem to think they need a different standard for startup, shutdown, and maintenance. And I was curious to know whether you thought it was possible to fashion a 112D compliance standard for that period other than the standard that applies at all other times. And your answer to that is no.
I believe not.
Uh-huh. Can I take you back, Mr. Pugh? By the way, I found your doing the addendum this way is very helpful. And I appreciate it. I don't have to look at two different volumes and get all the statutes and the regs right there. But if I look at there are three regulations involved in this, as I see it. Is that right?
Well, there are actually four regulations. The last one was a very minor decision in 2007 to deny reconsideration. So really, there are only three regulations.
Three. There's one that deals with non-opacity.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand your question.
Okay, on the startup, shutdown, malfunction. There's one that deals with non-opacity emissions, et cetera, et cetera. There's one that deals with visible and opacity emissions, and then there's the one that you've been sort of focusing on that says minimize during startup, shutdown, right?
Yes. Okay.
So the three regulations, and they're at. Your addendum 184, 186, and 187. And you know, I mean, I can read them, 63.6H1 and so on and so forth, but you know them by heart. I have a very simple question. the language in each one of these subsections of 40 CFR 63.6, has that remained the same since 1994?
Yes.
There's not a word that's been changed?
No.
Okay. So then why is it that you have that you're not out of the, you have 60 days to challenge a regulation, and it's been a little bit longer than 60 days. It's been 14 years. So, you know, how do you get around it?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has consistently held, first in the Kennecott Copper case, again in the National Association of Manufacturers case in 1998, and most recently in the Environmental Defense case in 2006, that an agency can reopen a rule for judicial review by changing the regulatory context for that rule in a way that the parties could not have anticipated when the rule was first promulgated, and in a way that changes the stakes.
Makes it worse. All right. Now, I understand that, and I think you've stated it accurately. Here's a problem I have. Isn't it true that in 1994, compared with 2008, that EPA emission limitations were less stringent in 94? I mean, it's been a story of clamping down bit by bit by bit. And so that if there was pollution in startup, shutdown, and malfunction in 94, it would have resulted in more pollution than even today.
Your Honor, I just don't know the answer to that question. And the reason if
you don't know the answer to that question, then how can we make any kind of an evaluation under the Kennecott?
Well, what is clear is that our members are being deprived of very important protections that they had in 1994. In 1994, sources had to prepare a plan that spelled out how they would operate during startup shutdowns and malfunctions. When malfunctions occurred, they had to correct them as correctly or as quickly as practicable, quote, in accordance with the plan. So they had to actually follow their plans. The plans had to be vetted by state permitting authorities for adequacy in a process that was open to public participation. And most importantly, the plans were enforceable. They were just as mandatory and enforceable as emission limitations.
Does EPA agree with that?
I believe it does. I mean, it's actually laid out in the regulatory text of the 1994 rule. All of these requirements.
They incorporated the plan by reference. Is that the way it worked?
It was incorporated by reference into the Title V permit.
Okay.
But it was actually a separate regulatory provision that said that they were independently enforceable requirements. So that whole suite of
this is the minimization plan.
The startup it was just called the startup shutdown and malfunction plan, and it was actually, although it was called a plan, it was actually a very robust set of requirements tailed to each specific source that would require that source to minimize its emissions during startups and shutdowns and malfunctions, and those requirements have been completely stripped out. So for EPA to say that the fundamental proposition hasn't changed is a bit like saying that you can pull the safety net out from under a high wire and the high wire hasn't changed.
They don't have to minimize anymore?
Well, there is still the general duty to minimize emissions, but that is nothing like the very specific requirements that each source had to have.
Where did those requirements come from? Was this guidance documents or something?
Well, no, it was actually in the regulatory text. Okay. And EPA itself understood how important the plan requirements were to the exemption, because when it promulgated the exemption in the 1994 rule, it said in that very same rule, it responding to comments about why it wasn't requiring emissions standards to be enforced during startup shutdowns and malfunctions, it pointed to the plan requirements, not the general duty, and said these plan requirements are the bridge between requiring compliance at all times on the one hand and providing a blanket exemption from emission limits on the other.
Assuming we get over that hurdle, let me just ask you so I'm clear. We've had dictum in a number of our cases, as the government's brief points out, that suggests that having a different standard than the MAC standard I can't remember the verbs we use, but at any rate, the agency might have authority to promulgate such a regime. And EPA says that your client has recognized not only that the general duty is a default, but sought to enforce it. And what I'm trying to understand, and maybe you can explain, if I'm a major source And the MAC standard requires me to reduce, I don't know, 1,000 units every 24 hours. And some equipment fails. As I understand your position, it's that I still have that obligation to reduce 1,000 units every 24 hours. And I may have a plan that says what I'm going to do to mitigate that situation to the greatest extent possible. And under the 94 regime, because it was publicly vetted, et cetera, it was very clear what the source had to do. But that plan contemplated, didn't it, that nevertheless during that period where there's a malfunction, I would not be complying with the MAC standard. I would be doing something else, namely whatever is in the SSM plan. Isn't that tantamount to the scheme that the agency has suggested in this 2006 rule?
No, Your Honor. Here's the important difference. In 1994, you're right, sources were exempted from compliance with emission standards when they were malfunctioning, and they had to comply with the general duty. Plus, they had to comply with all of these detailed and enforceable requirements that they'd put in their own startup shutdown malfunction plans and that had then been approved, reviewed and approved by the permitting authority. The situation now is that you subtract out all of those plan requirements. All that's left is that sources are exempt from compliance with emission standards, and they have this vague general obligation to minimize emissions so long as it's consistent with what they regard as safety and good air pollution practices,
all
which
right.
means...
But as I understand the agency's brief, its argument is that nothing has changed except instead of doing this sort of forward-looking regulation where we have all of this vetting, et cetera, we're going to come in after the fact. And we think that record-keeping, et cetera, and record reporting provides us with sufficient information, plus whatever plan the source has. To be able to enforce the law.
That's what EPA says to explain why it thinks that the general duty requirement is enforceable, but it doesn't even speak to its deletion of all these completely separate requirements that used to be in the regulations and aren't anymore.
But its response is, we have determined these are no longer necessary, that what is necessary is filing these reports, telling us how you have either not followed whatever plan you have or tell us exactly what you did, and then we'll come in and inspect, and we'll evaluate, and we'll take it from there.
I think I would rather, if it's all right, I will defer that argument to my colleague.
All right.
But our position is that once EPA reopened the startup shutdown malfunction exemption, it necessarily reopened the legality of that exemption. And we contend that it is flatly at odds with Section 112 and Section 302K, because no matter what sources are doing other than following emission standards, as long as there is an interruption in compliance with emission standards, there's not continuous compliance. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Carrie Powell, and I also represent petitioners. The court should reject EPA's rule for the additional reason that it violates Clean Air Act Title V and is arbitrary. Title V requires that each major stationary source obtain an operating permit. That permit must include conditions as necessary to assure the source's compliance with each Clean Air Act requirement. In this rulemaking, EPA has declared that with respect to the general duty to minimize emissions, the only thing that a Title V permit must say to assure compliance with that duty is that a source must prepare a plan that identifies the steps it intends to take to minimize emissions and must report at least every 6 months whether it's implementing that plan. The plan itself won't be enforceable. It won't be subject to public review or government approval. And in most cases, the plan can be kept secret from the public. As a result, at the time a Title V permit is issued, no one but the source will have any idea what the source intends to do to minimize emissions. And even the source won't know whether the steps it's laid out in its plan will be sufficient to comply.
Well, the agency says the rule says the administrator can request this plan from the source and look at it.
Title V is meant not just to assure compliance to the government, but also to the public. And Title V is explicit in that regard.
And it says that the administrator must promulgate regulations to provide reasonable regulations under reasonable conditions or something like that.
No, Your Honor, the rule expressly does not provide that the plan ever be made available to the public unless it happens that the government has obtained it from the source.
It's expressly silent on that point. Is that your...
No, it provide that a member of the public can ask the administrator to get the report.
Yes, but there is
And then it's a discretionary decision as to whether the public ever gets it.
That's correct. And our
statute, can be read consistent with the notion that there's no absolute right of the public to get the report, to get the plan.
Your Honor, under Section 503E of the statute, which is 7661BE, a copy of each permit application, compliance plan, emissions or compliance monitoring report, certification, and each permit issued under this subchapter shall be available to the public. And more comprehensively,
on page 51 of EPA's brief, says, although the Sierra Club insists that SSM plans must be available to the public, the 2006 rule is neutral on this point. It does not address public disclosure of SSM plans. Are you telling us that that's wrong?
What EPA is saying is that it doesn't prevent public disclosure, but there's no dispute that it doesn't require public disclosure.
And that address the question the EPA says. Does the 2006 rule address the question? And if so, where?
I'm not exactly sure where the rule specifies public availability of the plan, but I do know that EPA has made it clear in their rulemakings that, and EPA hasn't disputed that there's no requirement that a plan be made available to the public. In fact, in its brief, EPA says that if the public is unable to get a copy of that plan, they can file a lawsuit and try to obtain it through discovery. And that does appear in EPA's brief. So certainly the rule never expressly says the public can never get hold of the plan, but it doesn't require that the plan be provided. And that is at the heart of the problem here. Title V doesn't just leave it up to the government to use its discretion as to whether to give valuable information to the public about what a source must do to comply with requirements, and giving the public access to reports and compliance plans that go with that process. Title V requires that.
But this isn't a requirement under Title V.
Well, Section 504A of the Clean Air Act requires that each permit include...
Is that, just so I'm clear, is that part of 7661A? Addendum.
It's 7661CA.
CA.
And under that rule, each...
Is that in your addendum, if you can just help me? I see 7661A, little a, on permit programs. And you cited in your brief 7661B8. But today you were citing E, and I just wanted to know where...
I cited E, which is actually the public availability...
Are you saying B as in boy or E as in Edward?
Excuse me. There's two different provisions I've been citing. The first is Section 7661BE, which...
7661...
B as in boy.
B as in boy.
Right.
E. And that's not in your addendum. At least I can't find it. Now, what's the other one you're citing?
The other one is Section 7661CA.
CA, which is also not in your addendum. So I'll go look it up. But those are the two, B subsection E and C subsection A, the public's right to have a copy of these plans, permits, et cetera.
Right, and fundamentally, what the statute requires is that each permit include conditions sufficient to assure compliance with each applicable requirement. And that permit, of course, is available to the public, as well as whatever reporting documents are then required to assure compliance under that permit. And that's where we run into a problem. The statute doesn't specifically set up the regime of startup shutdown malfunction plans. That was what EPA came up with to assure compliance with the general duty to minimize emissions. And EPA admits that if it were needed to have a startup shutdown malfunction plan to assure compliance with the general duty, then EPA would have to comply with Title V's requirements that the plan be incorporated into the permit, enforceable, and available to the public. How EPA seeks to get around Title V's requirements is to argue that while SSM plans are useful to assure compliance, they are not necessary. We ask the court to reject EPA's arguments because they rest...
What does one of these SSM startup shutdown plans look like? Give me an example of what it would say. DuPont Corporation in Wilmington, Delaware, on one of their plastic factories, has an SSM plan.
Well, the times that I've requested an SSM plan, I've gotten things back from my request that didn't consist of an SSM plan. But generally, they're going to vary tremendously depending upon the type of source that you've got, because the type of equipment will vary significantly. What counts as a startup or a shutdown will vary significantly. The point is that...
Is it something as simple as... I mean, it sounds very technical and all, but is it something as simple as that if there's a malfunction, shut the plant down? That's our malfunction plan.
It might consist of that. Under EPA's rule, the critical flaw here is we have no idea what it consists of. It could be a plan that was absurdly ridiculous and would in no way do anything to minimize emissions, and nobody would know that until well after the fact. Perhaps as late as 6 months later, EPA would get reports, or the permitting authority would get reports.
Why would a plant need a plan for startup?
Actually, startup can take quite a while. It can take, it's my understanding, it can take many, many hours. And during that time, apparently, it's somewhat common that there are emission exceedances above what the MACT emission limits would otherwise require. And under those circumstances, the facility can take certain actions. And EPA has long held, by the way, that startup and shutdown are events that are planned. They are expected, generally, and the source knows what's going on at that time, and they can take steps to minimize their emissions and probably keep them below the emission limit that would otherwise apply. So these are very source-specific plans, but the key point is that they take this very general obligation and they translate it into the specifics of what a facility must do in order to minimize its emissions. And that is essential here because you cannot have assurance that a source is complying with the general duty if you don't have any idea what the source intends to do.
Well, as I understand it, the agency is saying the administrator can get these plans and in discretion turn them over to the public, and through this reporting mechanism, the agency will have the information it needs to be able to determine whether or not the general duty is being complied with.
Your Honor, there's two very significant flaws with that approach. First, it fundamentally doesn't address the issue of what a source must do to comply with the general duty to minimize emissions until after a violation has already occurred.
So you read the statutory requirement to be that there must be an approved plan in existence?
The statutory requirement is that ahead of time, for each general requirement like this, there has to be conditions set out in the permit, or here what they had previously done under the 94 rule was require it to be put in a separate plan that was incorporated by reference. But that establishes up front what a source must do to comply with that requirement. And that is the idea that you need to establish up front what it takes to comply with the requirement is consistent with a common sense reading of the statutory language that a permit must assure compliance.
Are there guidance documents on what it means to minimize?
I don't know exactly what direction the sources have been given.
In this court, and I'm, probably all three of us are responsible for some of it, but there are just countless cases saying that when it comes to the remedy, when an agency is devising a remedy for a transgression, a violation, and that we cut the agency a lot of slack. Actually, the way that's put is they had wide discretion, or discretion is at its zenith, and so on and so forth. Why shouldn't a similar regime apply when what we're talking about is the agency's system for detecting violations?
Your Honor, this isn't just a system for detecting violations. Assuring compliance means, and as the legislative history spoke directly to these issues, the Senate report, which appears on page 844 of the Joint Appendix, covers a lot of this territory, and they explain that a big reason for Title V is not just to wait until it's time to go to court and enforce against a violation, but if there's agreement ahead of time in the Title V permit what a source must do to comply, then it's far more likely that the source will comply in the first place, and the public won't be exposed to these extra hazardous toxic emissions. And if you look at the Senate report, the Senate goes on to explain that one of the key roles of Title V in assuring compliance is to clarify how the general rules apply to a specific source, because you cannot be assured of compliance if you don't know what compliance means. I see that I'm well over my time. Are there further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. I'm Dan Durkee for the U.S. Department of Justice. With me at council table is Sheila Igo from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of General Counsel. Your Honor, I think petitioners' arguments have two fundamental misconceptions, one for each line of argument. On the line of argument about whether there are continuous standards or not, and whether they satisfy 112D of the Act or the definitions of emission standard, their error is to assume that what EPA did in the regulations 63.6F1 and H1 is an automatic exemption that applies across the board without more. And it's actually not
without,
that.
Without what?
Without more being done. And it's
without
not that.
What?
I'm sorry.
Say it again.
They say that it's an automatic exemption that applies across the board without more.
Well, do you, the agency doesn't, I didn't think, are you saying that the general duty complies with Section 112D?
Our position is that's an inquiry that only makes sense in the particular niche apps in which it's applied.
Because in the particular what?
The particular 112D standards, the emission standards. Because the general duty, and indeed everything in Part 63, each of the regulations that's being challenged, is like a menu of options that EPA can and has to choose from when it's promulgating an emission standard for a particular source category.
Well, can a source can a source be in under the EPA standards? Can a source be in compliance during SSM without following a standard that meets 112D, that is, that's based on the maximum achievable reduction obtained by the best performing source?
No, the source has to comply with the standard under 112D. The question here is, what does that standard include and contain? What does it look like? And as some of the questions for Mr. Pugh elucidated, that standard, our position is that standard does not have to be the same without change. Continuous does not mean unaltered.
Well, then I take it the answer to my question is no, that during SSM, sources do not have to comply with the maximum achievable reduction obtained by the best performing source.
No, we say they do comply and that they should be complying and are complying.
They can't reach the same level of emission control when they're starting up, shutting down, or quite obviously when they're not functioning correctly.
Right. It's not going to be the same level of control. And what they're,
even though it's the best available, or the whatever it is, and best available, you know, maximum through the best available technology.
Right, and that's why I think it's important to recognize that in the regulations being challenged, they're on the shelf, ready to be applied in specific 112D standards.
No, but here, I don't understand why that's true. I operate a steel plant. I turn the switch on at 6 a.m. It takes a couple of hours for everything to get operating 100%. But the MAC standard says within a 24-hour period, I have to reduce by 1,000 units. So knowing that, what I have to do, given those 2 hours where I'm not operating as efficiently, means that for the other 22 hours, I have to make up for that period of time. Well, that's how you arguably would always be in compliance with the MAC standard.
Well, that might work depending on how compliance is measured and over what period of time it's measured, but it wouldn't work for all situations or for, say, a malfunction.
I know. In the preamble, there's a lot of chatter about how, well, in some instances, EPA has looked at startup and shutdown, and where these things are very recurrent, it has adjusted the MAC standard accordingly, and it gives us one example involving one hazardous pollutant.
Right.
But we have nothing that I could find in the record that says it is the exception where this is not done, such that therefore, under this exemption under the rule, we're really talking about a very small and almost unique category of sources.
It's not the only one, but it wouldn't be fair to say that it's everyone. Most of the standards do adopt what's in 63.6 F1. Not all of them do. And the
intervene in F1? That's the general duty.
No, E1 is the general duty, E3 is the plan to comply with the duty, and F1 says the standards during normal operating periods don't apply during SSM.
Okay, so that's my question right there. You just said the standards applicable during normal operating periods don't apply during SSM.
Right, but the general duty under E1 does apply, and that's part of...
Okay, but the general duty is different, correct, than the standards that apply during non-SSM.
I think I might be using standards in a different way, because the 112D standard includes both together the general duty plus the normal operating limitations form the 112D standard. And in that sense, the source has to comply with the standard at all times. And which part of that standard and how strict it is depends on whether you're in a startup, shutdown, or malfunction or normal operating period.
Well, let me ask.
That's another way of saying that they don't have to comply during the SSM period.
But they don't have. But petitioners will have you think that they don't have to comply with anything, and there are no rules.
No, I understand. You got the default general duty.
Right.
Their argument is that that's not the same as a 112D standard.
Well, the context in which to answer that question should be in the particular standard, because different industries are different.
I don't know what that means. What you just said. Either I thought you said it exactly right about six sentences ago when you said that the standards that apply during SSM are not the standards that apply during normal operational periods. That's what you said.
That is what I'm saying, and that's correct.
And that makes sense to me.
But
the question is, does that comply with the statute?
Right? And I think you have to look at it in a particular context.
No. Can we put the context off for a minute?
I think it does comply with the statute.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, as I understand the statute, it says Section 112D sets the standard. Sources have to meet standards that evolve from maximum achievable reduction by the best measured by the best performing source, right? That yields a standard for that category of sources.
Right.
Correct? Okay. And that has to be, an emission standard is continuous, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And I agree with you, that doesn't mean the same all the time, but it's continuous, okay? Now, I only found one exception to that in the statute, which is 112H, when it's not feasible. And they give two standards for when it's not feasible, and I don't understand that EPA is not claiming that this is a 112H situation, correct?
Correct, we're not claiming that.
Okay. So then, hasn't the agency created an exemption that's not in the statute?
No, because the maximum achievable reduction in limitations depends on the situation.
What? Say again?
The maximum achievable reduction in limitations, what D3 requires, depends on the situation. And
there are different standards for different categories of sources.
But
within a category of sources, the 112D standard has to apply continuously.
But even within the category of sources and within the standard that EPA sets, there can be variations in EPA recognizes.
And where does that come from? Where do you get that authority in the statute?
Well, because
H looks like the only exception to a continuous to the 112D continuous standard. There's two exceptions.
But again, we read the general duty as part of the D standard.
Of the what standard?
Part of the
112D?
Yes.
Well, is it based on the performance of the best performing source?
And again,
it isn't, right?
It should be, but in the general provisions, looking at it in the abstract, you can't say because you don't know what the best performing source is. And when EPA
if you don't know what the best performing source is, you know what the best performing source is for all categories, don't you? Normal operating times.
When EPA promulgates the rule
right.
for that category.
For that category. So we and the and but you don't know. So are you saying that you could measure this by the best performing source during SSM?
Well, typically EPA doesn't have the information to put a numerical value on that. But when EPA promulgates any given standard, 112D standard, it has to make the affirmative choice of what to do during SSM periods.
Well, no, but that's not what the statute says. The statute says you have to have 112D standards operating continuously, except in two circumstances described in H where it's infeasible.
Well, I think the key is
I don't see an exception in the statute for periods of time of startup, shutdown, and malfunction.
Well, I think the key is we're not saying it is an exemption. We're not saying if we said that that there was no general duty and
No. I understand you have a standard. The general duty is a standard. I understand that. But the question is, in view of the way the statute's written, don't we have to ask whether the general duty complies with 112D?
Yes. And we
and it doesn't.
No, we say it does.
Well, why? Is it based on the performance of the maximum, the best performing source?
I'm sorry that we're talking past each other, but you can't answer that question in the abstract. You say in a particular industry, say a refinery, is the standard we're promulgating?
Okay, look, let's go back to Judge Rogers. What was it, a plastic factory you had? Okay.
Yeah.
You got a plastics factory, okay? And it's got a machine in it that is a particular source. I don't know what it is, but it's a source category, right?
Right.
And it has a max standard,
right.
correct? All right. We agree with that?
Yes.
That's how it works. Okay. So, and that max standard under the statute applies continuously, correct?
The MAC, the let's
say...
The
emission standard is defined as something that applies continuously.
Right. Well, let's say, what you're calling MAC, let's say, is a number.
There's a number, a yes.
Pound per
exactly.
day or whatever that needs
right.
to
that's
be
based MAC. On the best performing source.
Right.
And that's the standard for that source category, that
plus,
plastic factory in Wilmington.
But we say it's not just that numerical limit. It's that plus the general duty makes
but
a continuous standard.
You see,
standard.
That's what I'm asking you.
Right.
Where do you get that in the statute? The statute says, the statute seems very clear to me. It says 112D, it defines what an emission standard is. And then it gives you two exceptions, both of which relate to infeasibility. And even under those two exceptions, you have to, when the agency invokes those, it has to still adopt a particular kind of standard, correct?
And
yes. But so where in this statute is this third exception that you found?
Well, we don't see it as an exception. And maybe if I put in a different factual context. Instead of a steel factory, take the factual context
okay.
of an industry that does batch processing, where there's a lot of starting up and shutting down.
Uh-huh.
Now, when EPA promulgates the emission standard and decides what is MACed for that
uh-huh.
industry, it can, and in cases has said, well, startup and shutdown for you is part of your normal operating conditions, so the numerical pounds per day is going to apply for you during startup and shutdown and is the MAC.
Okay, good. Now that facility seems to me to be complying with the statute. What's the other one?
But in that same standard, EPA says, but malfunctions are different. And for malfunctions, the numerical level.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but you're not answering my question about where you find this in this. Well, let me ask you this. This case looks to me exactly like New Jersey versus EPA, which we decided, I think, last year, right? You're familiar with that?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Oh. Well, your office handled it here last year.
I apologize, Your
okay.
Honor, but...
Well, let me just tell you, that was the case where the question was how a source can be delisted.
Okay.
Remember that?
Okay.
And 112C9 gives the very precise procedures for delisting the source. And in that particular case, it involved electric utility steam units or something. EPA conceded that it had delisted the source, but it didn't make the C9 findings.
Okay.
And here's what we said about that. Quote, EPA cannot construe, I think I'm quoting Judge Rogers here, right?
Right.
This is a really good sentence. EPA cannot construe a statute in a way that completely nullifies textually applicable standards, textually applicable standards meant to limit its discretion. That's this case. Congress said, the agency has to issue 112D standards, and it provided the agency with two exceptions, neither of which you invoke. So I don't see how you can defend this under the statute.
Well, two responses, Your Honor. First,
is that what the petitioners argued? I thought their argument was that the problem here is that the emission limitations that are generally set for all other times are required to be continuous, and you can't create an exemption for SSM.
That's what I just said.
The SSM.
That's what I just said.
They say it's a step one.
That's what I just said.
You
said it better than I did.
I have two responses. If we agree that, if the court agrees with our position that an emission limitation to be continuous doesn't have to be unchanging, then the question is, how do you change it?
But according to the statute,
you
can.
On that, right. The petitioners lose because their entire argument was just the opposite. That's my point. I don't remember seeing in their brief, and I've just looked for it. Maybe it's there. Maybe Mr. Pugh can tell me. But the notion that whatever standard is set differently for SSM has to be set in accordance with, you know, the best available technology and the best performing source. I don't remember seeing that argument.
Well, we can ask him. I think their argument is in the brief that the standards must be 112D compliant. Now, when I asked him whether it was possible to fashion a 112D compliant standard for SSM that was different from normal times, he said no. So,
and we disagree with that. It is possible.
But you told me that you told me that under the general duty, they do not have to meet a standard that is based on the maximum feasible reduction produced by the best available source.
No, I'm saying under the general duty, they don't have to meet a standard that's set based on normal operating conditions. That's different than saying it doesn't have to be based on the maximum achievable reduction. The general duty may well be, and in many cases is, the maximum achievable.
It's the best that a plastic plant can do in starting up.
Or shutting down or malfunctioning.
Or shutting down.
And if EPA has information that says a specific industry is different and it can do better.
I asked Mr. Pugh, I don't see an argument that the standard were any different. I'm confused about this whole plan business. The 663.6E contains all these requirements about what in the addendum here contains just a ton of requirements about what these plans have to contain.
Right.
Is that addendum the current law?
I think the statutory addendum is copied from the 2007 regulation, so that should be current. Yes.
So, what have I missed here in terms of what has gotten stripped out?
Well, that's a disagreement we have with the plaintiffs. We think the plan requirements are just as robust in what the source must do. They still must have a plan.
Three single space pages of stuff that has to be in the plan.
What's been changed is whether the plan has to be automatically turned over whenever a citizen requests it.
The EPA, but it has to be, it has to be, there are requirements that I read that say that if the EPA administrator requests a copy of the plan, it has to be delivered within 5 business days or something. I don't know what it is.
That's right. And to answer, I think
there's a reasonable request.
That was an older version.
Isn't that different? Isn't that different from the way it operated earlier?
That is different, and that's the reasonableness was taken out, and the regulation says now it is, as Judge Randolph said, it's neutral on it. And to answer your question from earlier, Judge Randolph, where is it in the rule that it has to be made available if EPA has it? That's the statute, 114C of the statute, 7414C.
If EPA has a copy, then the EPA has to make it available, is that what you're saying?
Yes, if EPA has anything.
And EPA has to review these plans, doesn't it?
Well, the EPA can choose to. EPA can, in the course of an inspection, say, I want to see your plan. It's no obligation for EPA to go to every source, every industry, every facility in the nation and look at every plan.
But there's no requirement under this regime that there be any approval of the plan.
That's right, and
the question is, then under the statutory language, how do you assure compliance with the 1112 standard?
And we say that the record keeping and reporting assures compliance. If the plaintiffs were correct that the plan were an enforceable requirement and it had to be in the permit, that's the old way from 1994.
But as I understand the rule, doesn't it contemplate this type of situation? I am the owner or operator of a source, and I have a plan on my bookshelf, and something goes wrong, we suffer a malfunction. A citizen writes a letter to the administrator saying, I'd like to see this plan. And let's assume the administrator gets it from the source and turns it over. And then when the citizen writes the administrator again, the citizen points out, this plan is worthless. for all kinds of reasons, and the administrator says, I agree, then what happens?
The legal standard that governs that factory's operations is not the plan, it's the duty to minimize.
And my point is that, as I understand the rule, it's that, of course, under 114, the agency has authority to make investigations, to require reports, and all those things. And so nothing happens unless the administrator initiates some action.
No, what will happen is that factory already has to report what it did.
Right.
And that report.
And I'm a very busy administrator, so you know I'll get to it when I can.
But the citizens get that. There's a distinction that Sierra Club.
And so all the citizen can do is go to court, right?
Well, that's all they could do anyway to enforce the requirement.
No. In the old regime, they got the plan, and the administrator had to approve it in advance. So they were able to be sure that there was a plan out there that at least the administrator thought would assure compliance with the MAC standard.
That's true. But the way the regulations currently work also assures compliance, because what happens is if something happens at that factory, they have to make a record of what they did and what happened and whether there's exceedance, and they have to do a report. And that report goes to the regulator, and because the regulator has it, the statute says the citizen can get it. And the report is much more valuable than the plan, because the report doesn't say, here's what we plan to do if we think X, Y, and Z happens.
No,
the report says.
I suppose all of us have been and heard too many of these cases. EPA doesn't have the staff to do this kind of monumental investigating of each and every source. It doesn't have the staff to read all these reports. It doesn't have the staff to do all these independent evaluations. So the citizen gets a report and tries to get the administrator to focus on it and do things. And meanwhile, you know, years have passed, and the source is still emitting and exceeding the MAC standard, at least according to the complaint. And nobody knows whether that's true or not, arguably. And is that the kind of scheme that's consistent with, you know, the 1990 amendments that were designed to basically limit EPA's discretion and to force it to do things up front?
Well, I don't think that's would necessarily what happened, but I don't think that's what would happen. That's not inconsistent with the 90 Act, because two points. One is, even if it were a straightforward pounds per day numerical limit, we all agree is a emission standard, there could still be situations where EPA, for whatever reason, decides not to enforce.
What's the role of the state, local, the permitting authority?
The state permit authority is actually more often than not the one on the front lines, because the Title V permits are written by either state or local agencies.
Right.
They're the inspector.
They complain, as EPA notes, that they can't always get these plans either. And the agency says, well, we expect the sources to cooperate and the administrator to cooperate.
And there's nothing in the record to say that citizens have tried to get these plans and have not.
I'm talking about state permitting.
There's a comment that says the state wants more authority, and EPA reasonably said you have enough authority.
Oh, they say they have trouble getting these plans.
The state says they have trouble, but the response to that in the record from EPA is the statute gives you enough authority. We don't see the need to give you
enough
more
authority to get the plans.
To get the plan, right?
Under the 94 regs, didn't the state authority have to review and approve the plans?
Yes, the state, because.
And that's not true anymore, right?
That's right, because the plan in 94 was.
Isn't
part
that
of the
enough
permit.
Of a difference right there to have changed the circumstances, the situation?
It's not. And to the answer why, I think, goes back to how Judge Randolph started us off, was that there's three regulations at issue. There's E1, which is the general duty, there's E3, which is the plan, and there's F, which says when the normal operating condition standard applies and not. Whether the plan under E3 is enforceable or not affects affects the duty, because the plan says either you're complying with the duty or not complying with the duty. All the changes over the years to the plan affects the duty, completely separate from F. F was never, Mr. Pugh acknowledged, F was never changed. It's been in the regulation since 94. It was presumed to continue. EPA repeatedly said we're not reopening that.
You can't exempt that startup and the shutdown and so on and so forth. You can't do that. But we're satisfied with it as long as you enforce that lack of duty. And as soon as we find out that that maybe your enforcement mechanism is weakened, then we have a right to come in and sue. I mean, that makes no sense at all. And that's basically the position that I see Mr. Pugh taking. I mean, you'll have a chance for a rebuttal. So.
and to respond, to finish my response to Judge Rogers, don't forget the citizens. If the citizens feel EPA is not doing their job and is not enforcing, they can sue. And as we cited in a brief, they do sue.
History says they have to go back to Congress and get the statute changed.
Well, no, they sue for violations of the same kind of general duty, which they say is vague and unenforceable. They sue for the exact same violations of the exact same kind of duty in reported cases. Now, they'll say, well, we don't always win, but that's not the point. They have the right to sue, and they do exercise it. I've gone over my time. I'm happy to answer additional questions, if I could have a concluding thought that we didn't get into the waiver argument, although we alluded to it a bit at times. We think that before even reaching the Chevron 1 or Chevron 2 analysis, much less the Title 5 analysis, the court should look at the waiver analysis.
I thought that's what we were just talking about.
Well, right, that under Kennicott, we think there has not been a constructive.
Yeah, but isn't that what we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes?
Well, that was what we were talking about E3. That's the reason why they have not.
You think that because?
I think that it has not been constructively reopened because what we reopened was E3, the plan requirements. And Kennicott is very clear that.
Can I ask you just a quick question about this issue since you raised it?
Sure.
Do you have the blue brief there? Do you have the petitioner's brief?
Yes.
Okay, open it up to page 29 to 30.
This is their opening brief?
Yeah.
21.
29 to 30.
I'm sorry.
Okay. 29 to 30.
Oh, 29 to 30. Okay.
Yeah. See, there they describe, they say, to avoid creating a blanket exemption. You see where it
yes.
is? There? Okay. Then they have these four requirements, and then they go on and say those four requirements were eliminated. Is that an accurate? You didn't disagree in your brief with this portion of their brief. I'm just asking about it factually.
I'm reading it now. It says the sources have to comply with their plans during periods of SSM.
Right.
The plans have to be reviewed. The plans have to be unconditionally available, and the plan provisions be directly enforced. That's
right.
Correct.
That's all right. And then you agree with the rest of it. Where forget the sentence where they agree with the change, the way it's changed. Read on.
That in the rulemakings.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's all accurate.
Right. That is
okay.
That is factually correct.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll give you 3 minutes, Mr. Pugh.
Mr. Pugh, did I accurately describe your argument?
Yes.
Okay. Whew.
Which one?
On the merits of the statute. Your argument is, as I understand it, that 112D, the only exceptions to that 112D standards must be continuous, that there are two feasibility exceptions, neither of which are invoked here. Correct?
Yes.
End of case.
Do you go on to argue that if SSM standards, it's permissible to have an addition, a different emission limitation standard for SSM, that it has to comply with 112B?
Your Honor, what we said is
Do you argue that? And,
yes,
and where in your brief did you argue that?
We say that
if it's different, it's got to do X.
In our opening brief, we cover that, I think, in a footnote, saying that these standards do not purport to comply with Section 112D or Section 112H.
A footnote. Where is that?
In the opening brief, it would probably be, let's see. There's a footnote 6 on page 24 and a footnote 7 on 25. The reason these are dealt with in
talking about work practice or operational.
Well, the footnote 7 on page 25 says any claim that the general duty requirement is an emission standard would run afoul of Section D3's minimum stringency requirements, and likewise, in the next sentence, any claim that it's a work practice standard under 112H would run afoul of 112H.
It's work practice standards. It's not the, Judge Tatel was making an argument based on not 112D, but 112B, I thought.
Mm-hmm. 112D.
D?
D.
D isn't
David.
You know, I had argued a case in the Supreme Court once and won, but it all revolved around a footnote. It's called in the Antitrust Expediting Act. And I'll never forget, Justice Douglas dissented, and he dropped a footnote in his dissent, quoting Chief Justice Hughes, who said, "Footnotes don't count." He said it in a footnote.
Seems appropriate, too. Your Honor, we wouldn't have put it in a footnote, but EPA has never claimed that these things are emission standards. That's the only reason it went in a footnote. I think that the text resolves the issue, but I would just like to talk about the logical conclusion of EPA's argument, which is that EPA could completely abrogate both the continuous compliance requirement and the stringency requirements in D2 and D3 if it were correct. It could say that sources could comply with an EPA-fabricated duty that doesn't even purport to implement any statutory provision 90% of the time. If that were correct. And that's not even very far-fetched. The record shows that there are sources that are operating in startup shutdown malfunction mode 25% of the time already.
And are your comments in this record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Are they in the addendum?
No, I think the comments are in the joint appendix.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks. You're out of time, but we'll give you 3 minutes. Okay.
Thank you. I just want to quickly address why the reporting requirements are not sufficient to assure compliance. First, as we discussed before, you only get the reports after the violation has already occurred. Second, EPA's position that those reports by themselves without access to the SSM plan are sufficient is arbitrary because it contravenes the statement in EPA's own regulations that the purpose of the SSM plans is to ensure compliance with the general duty. Third, EPA, when these reports are filed...
Let me ask you, that statement was in the 94.
Your Honor, it was in the 94 rules, and it's retained there today.
But in the 2006, they say they see those plans as helpful. Go ahead.
That's what they argue. But in 63.6E3I, they still declare that the purpose of the SSM plan is to ensure compliance. And when that point was raised with them, they just said that, well, we understand that our reporting requirements are anachronistic because they were set up at a time when the SSM plan was actually in the permit and was enforceable.
Right.
And it's significant that if you look at their brief, while they claim that the reporting requirements are sufficient to assure compliance, they never actually say why. In the brief. And if you look back and see what EPA said in 2007 for why the reporting requirements are sufficient, in JA 344, there's a very short Federal Register notice that addresses this exact issue. And what EPA said was that if a report shows an unusually high number of startup shutdown and malfunction events, then EPA's inspectors will take a look at the startup shutdown malfunction plan. And if it isn't adequate, they'll require the source to upgrade it. And if it isn't adequate, they'll hold the source accountable for violating the general duty. So it's crystal clear that under EPA's approach to assuring compliance, the SSM plan is at the heart. And it is not just the records filed after an event. And keep in mind, because the plan is never reviewed for adequacy, you have no guarantee at all, no reason to believe that when you get those reports and they identify the steps taken that were consistent with the plan, there's no reason to believe that those are sufficient to minimize emissions. So you're left without any certainty here. That can't possibly assure compliance, even if it's acceptable to just set up a regime where you figure out what a source should have been doing after it violates the law. And finally, EPA claims that it's possible to enforce these requirements in court without actually having a plan. But if you take a look at those enforcement cases, they make it crystal clear that it is essential to document ahead of time what a source has to do to comply with its general duty. When you don't have that, it's extremely hard even to take the source to court. And I just let me clarify that on JA 316, there's a statement in EPA's Federal Register notice declaring, and I'll quote, "Any permitting authority with delegation will have discretion to obtain plans requested by the public, but will not be required to do so." Thank you.